Tape 2, Side 1. National Council of Jewish Women Oral History Project. I am Mildred Menlo. With my partner, Ruth Weiner, we are interviewing Mr. Len Arcus in his office on July 6th, 1992.
When I first became director, I began getting various criticisms, and I wondered where they all emanated from. And I discovered it was my predecessor who was doing them all. You see, and I learned one thing: when you leave a job, you really should get out of town.
You're right. That was Washburn?
Washburn wasn't out of. He knew nothing was going on here, refused to visit Pittsburgh ever after. And yet he was critical of paintings I bought, which he never saw, of things of that nature. And it was very upsetting, since Gordon was a good friend. You know, I had known him since I was a kid. And this is really... He had a problem. He had a peculiar sort of an ego. And here's one of the men who should have been one of the outstanding museum directors in the entire world. Brilliant, superb presence, could talk extemporaneously so easily. He wrote with a facility that I envy. And yet, he was very uncertain of himself. He was terribly so. And he suffered from the worst... I don't know why I'm getting into a criticism of Washburn.
That's right.
The worst problem he had was he could not think of ideas. He could take your ideas and turn them into the most fabulous things in the world.
He was not an innovator.
But he was not an innovator at all. Things just got out. I'll never forget, we both worked on a show simultaneously. The exhibition was that of the works by Jay Leff, owned by Jay Leff.
Yes, I knew Jay.
L-E-F-F, J-A-Y-L-E-F-F. Mm-hmm. He came from Uniontown, rather, he was there at the time. He now lives here.
His family was from Uniontown.
Jay had amassed a collection of several thousand African, pre-Columbian, Oceanic, and actually an awful lot of Asiatic material. It ranged everywhere from, it's sort of peculiar esoterica, you know, that he bought for next to nothing. He bought very expertly, and I must say his knowledge was sensational. I was astounded that anything of that nature was in our midst. We worked on the show because neither of us knew anything about African, about pre-Columbian or any of this material except a bit of the Oriental. And we read the same books. It's very amazing what came out. When I read Gordon's introduction, it was much more scholarly, much more interesting, and much more exciting than any of the books I'd read. It sounded though these were all his points. He had a way of absorption and putting it through so clearly that it was a gift, a fantastic gift. But speaking about him, I'll tell you more if you're interested. He went to Williams, and he went up to Harvard, went through the fog, became the fair-haired boy of Paul Sachs, the famous museum maker, and then upon graduating, being about that time about 23, 24, became the youngest museum director in the country. He became the director of the Albright, that time called the Albright Gallery, now the Albright Knox in Buffalo. And did a brilliant job there. Godwin was a very, very fascinating guy. He's a very handsome man. He certainly had all the ladies working for him. And when I say that, I'm speaking of our women's committee and the work they did before every international. And right up to sweeping the floors and everything else, it was incredible. And but we worked very closely together. In fact, I think at one point of the game, I was very seriously trying to get out of the job, find a new one, because of I began to feel myself being submerged completely in the personality of Gordon Washburn. And that's not uncommon and a very fair reason for moving. A peculiar thing comes to mind. I was just writing about it. There was a man named Kaniuk. I think it's K-A-N-I-U-K. He was the director of the museum in Tel Aviv, which was quite a thing. They have two big ones there. The one in Tel Aviv was more of a contemporary museum. He came to Pittsburgh and for the purpose of having lunch. I didn't know nothing about it until I was suddenly asked to have lunch with him. He was retiring and asked me if I'd be interested in the job, which sort of took me aback. Because having spent 4 years in the Middle East, I don't think anything was less desirable to my knowledge. I had enough time away from home. But more than that, I told him a story which I thought was very appropriate. I told him the incident of how, when I was in at that time, Palestine, was our leave center. I was walking along streets and suddenly I realized here was this concert being played and I hadn't heard a concert in 3 years. You know, this is incredible. I hadn't even heard any Western music except occasional BBC that would come through. And here they're doing the Beethoven Fourth Piano Concerto. It was a very good program. And this side, I went right up and bought a ticket. That was an incredible experience. First of all, when I arrived that night to attend, I was seated 6 times before I ended up in a box. Then, finally the concert began about 20 minutes late. And the pianist, who was from South Africa, did very well. I was completely absorbed in this when I heard this incredible noise, which actually jerked me out of my seat. And I looked around me and nobody seemed to be paying any heed to the noise. It was just momentary noise. So I wondered if something was wrong with me and just sort of relaxed back. At another interval, I heard the same noise. The third time I caught it, I discovered that about 90% of the people in the orchestra were following the orchestra with the score.
Oh!
Turning the page. And this, as I told Kaniuk, with this many art historians, I could not exist. You know, absolutely could not exist. It was too much.
We found that part incredible.
That. What's that?
We found some of that incredible. The man cleaning the streets was the man who was sweeping the streets was listening to Bach.
Wonderful.
Wonderful little vignettes of that kind.
But then, something I never got over it. I don't know how. As I, Kaniuk laughed, he roared, because he said, you know, that's been my whole life. He said, battling constantly to be heard of everybody, everybody in the town would tell him how to run his museum. The poor man. At any rate,
When was that?
What?
When did this occur?
Oh, this occurred... Oh, Washburn was still here, so it'd be about 63. Connie died about a year or two later. Oh. It's too bad. He was a terribly nice person. And I don't know anything more about it, you know. But... I think I'll start today talking about when I first came to the Carnegie. Did I don't know what I spoke of last time, but did I tell you my first job was to rearrange the collection?
No.
Well, Gordon asked me to... The collection was put up any which way. It'd been that way since the beginning of use of the hall. I mean, you'd walk into a room and there was an American painting of the 20th century right next to a English portrait, and so forth, all the way through. As they came in, they were just hung up in any old way. And it was very disturbing, to say the least. Actually, it was very good, I'll tell you why. I didn't want to say, but I thought, we only used two galleries, two of the old galleries, for the permanent collection. And I said, aha, this is a wonderful time to get all this junk off the walls, downstairs, and let's bring up all the good stuff, and let's show our best. So I decided on sort of a line of quality, a sort of mean, and when I got through, I discovered I had about a dozen paintings left. So gradually, things had to come back and back. And so frankly, everything was back again. And the wonderful, the wise wisdom behind the old way of hanging was that you never saw how miserable the quality of our collection was. We had only about a dozen paintings. There's a wonderful painting over there by Ceasley, which inadvertently was bought back somewhere around 1897 or something. I don't know who the trustees were at that time, but I will say they made a mistake and bought an awfully good picture. and that was true. But the junk. And a lot of it's still down in the basement. Some of it is, I don't know. I'm a firm believer in quality. It's the only thing I know how to get along in art. I don't know any other reason. I'm not interested in the history of a thing. I'm interested in what it can tell you into exciting in you a love of art. If it can't do that, it's not performing a function. And we had all of these pleasantries. But you know, for years, even after I got up there, till I was finally director, I never was able to get our Bouguereau down off the walls into the basement. It didn't get down the basement, actually. I found a way of getting rid of it. I put it into the music hall as a decoration. That was a wonderful way out for a lot of things. It was the first picture that was brought back when I retired.
Really?
You know, all the stuff that you fight for, because you want to get rid of all the mediocrity of the past, to have it come back to you is really sad. Because you're fighting for a goal, an achievement. At any rate, I'm very proud with what happened in the intervening years. Because we now have a collection that is worthy of a museum. We were not actually a museum when I came here. We were called the Department of Fine Arts Carnegie Institute. There was also a Department of Fine Arts, Carnegie, at that time known as Carnegie Museum, Carnegie Institute of Technology. I don't have to tell you how many times our exhibitions ended up there. and had to be transferred. Oh, what a mess. Mail and all.
I don't understand.
Well, somebody, why we were called the Department of Art, I don't know.
Oh, rather, I understand. Rather than the School of Fine Arts.
Carnegie, really, real interest, I think, was natural history. And he created the Department of the Museum. His later idea about fine arts collection, I don't know if it's later or not, because both museums came into existence at the same time. The library was about a year younger, older, a big part. It was started in 1895, the rest of the other two museums, 1896. Which was, for those days, was pretty early for a city like Pittsburgh. Not bad at all. Actually, it wasn't even New York did not have the first museum, you know. It was Baltimore.
Where is the old Baltimore Museum?
Peel. Peel was the one. Charles Wilson Peel was the one who set it up. Painted. But also an amazing man. He invented the diorama. He invented everything. So many things are incredible. And, well, I'm not going into the story of Peel. It fascinates me. Actually, as you succeed, I sure learned it here. When you get one good picture, it's amazing how a second comes along.
May I ask a question here?
Surely.
About a second comes along. Has the Pittsburgh community, the people of wealth, the financial wizards,
no.
etc., have they been truly supportive of the museum?
That's a hard question because some have, to a great degree, Mrs. Scaife. Others gave it away elsewhere. Andrew Mellon, National Gallery. Frick, the Frick Collection in New York. A man whom I greatly revered, Duncan Phillips, built his own museum in Washington. He was living there.
Recently, the one in Richmond.
I'll start give you more. Ahrensburg gave the Ahrensburg Collection of Philadelphia. These are all Pittsburghers. We had very few people who felt an obligation to Pittsburgh. A remarkable man named Charles Rosenblum.
Yes, I know.
Charlie was a very good friend, and I liked him very much. He's a strange man. He's what I call a conversation ender. He could wear me out no time flat. I mean, every time I would make a point, he would say amen practically at the end of it, and then I'd have to think of something to keep the conversation going. Charlie, though, was a man who, he was driven by two things. There was the museum in Jerusalem and the one here. He was on the board here as the official Jew after Josiah Cohn was the original Jewish member on the board since 1896. We had very few Jews on the board. Until after the very end. It's amazing. Yet in other cities, the Jews were always
in the forefront.
The forefront, yes, the donors and all that. Charlie was a man, though, who, if I didn't ask for the world, I didn't ask him, if I asked for $5,000 or something, and didn't do it repetitively. I mean, you'd let a little interval go by. He was always there. That's one thing I can say for him more than anybody else. I could always go to him, especially if it pertained to prints or drawings, which he loved. And I'll never forget, I wanted so much to put the print collection into a decent order, because everything we had was falling apart. It was ancient. All the Solander boxes, these are those boxes that contain print, were all in pieces. I had to do tons of matting. All our mats were not chemical free and all that. And you had to do this. And I never forget going to him, and he listened to me out, and he didn't say anything. And for the first time, I walked away feeling defeat, you know, really defeated. And then he told me, he says, after listening to you, I don't think you asked for enough money. And so I got a check for twice as much. But that was Charlie. And there is one incident I should tell you about, how we got his collection. Charles had divided his collection in two parts. He felt that material, which definitely pertained to Jewish history or to Judaica in any form, should go to Israel. However, his Picasso prints and everything else should come here. I was very worried because here was a man who had one of the greatest collections of Rembrandt prints, of Durer prints in the whole world. Charlie had them. And to let that stuff get out of here, that was hard. He had other materials, Schoenorfers, he had everything of this nature, a tremendous collection, Schongauer and others. And I didn't know what to do. And yet the whole thing was resolved in one of the funniest ways imaginable. He had a little painting, it's hanging right now, about yay big. It's a portrait of Elijah, I think it is, I can be wrong, by an unknown Spanish 15th or 16th century artist, no one knows. And it's obvious, the picture had gone through some pretty rough treatment and had been repaired. He came to me one day and I've never seen him that crestfallen, really upset. And I said, Leon, he said, when is a picture? When is it past the point where it's no longer representative of being by a certain hand? And I didn't know what he was getting at until he told me that he had offered his painting to Israel, and whoever's director there turned him down flat. And turned him down by saying, it's obvious. This thing has been damaged. There's nothing left of the original. And we just can't accept it. Now, it happens to be a very interesting painting. It's not a piece of junk. So I turned to him and I said, Charles, why don't you let me have it? I'm going to get it x-rayed. I think there's a mistake here. And so he said, well, I'm glad to go ahead and do what you can. Well, we used to have a man who was a radiologist here who liked to play with making x-rays of paintings. We had nobody like that in the city. And I took it to him. And sure enough, while there were damages all over the picture, wherever the head of the figure was, nothing in the face or anything else was damaged. See that? And so I spoke to Charles and showed him it. The picture is perfectly legitimate in every sense. But the background, which was not even it was nothing but a design, you see, had been damaged and replaced. It's not of any importance. And he brightened. He said, I'll have to tell him that. And then I said, well, Charles, don't be rebuffed. Why don't you give it to us? And he looked at me. He says, you take it? I said, I damn well would. He says, it's yours.
You know?
And from there on, everything became ours. He did leave a number of things for Israel. And the interesting thing was the junk. We went through his whole collection, and I told him what I wasn't interested in, and all of that went to Israel. And the joke of it is, it never got to Israel.
What happened?
There was a very... What was the painting? What was the work that I wanted? Well, I don't know. It never got there. I went to New York, and the representatives of the museum there auctioned it. And so they got the money, and they never got anything of Charles's, which was very rotten, I must say, because it meant an awful lot to Charles. When Charles died, Lucille, his wife, came to me and said, if you take all these things out of this house, I won't have anything here. And I must say, she was perfectly right. So I went before my board and put in a big plea. We had to leave things there. And so they finally conceded. They're a rough bunch. Anyway, unfortunately, she insisted on the best picture of all. And she still got a work by Edward Hicks, which is a beauty. But we'll get that eventually.
Is she all right?
Lucille will never come down to the first floor. She's in her 90s. She's in a very rough state. I always considered myself one of her good friends. She won't see me. She only sees about two people, two women, and that's it.
She doesn't play anymore either.
Oh, she can't. You've got to remember, something very nasty happened here. Turn that off if you don't mind, because I don't know what to go on to now. I ask a question, let me get it.
I do want to go back to you. You wanted to talk about, and I wanted to talk about the staging the First International, but we have a list of very insignificant details that we need to fill in from your last interview. For example, we know that your brother lives in Pittsburgh. What is he doing? He's retired. I know that.
Nothing.
Oh.
He's quite older than I am. And just retired.
All right.
He used to be a public relations man. He's the man who a group of doctors came up. He was a pre-med student at Harvard when he graduated. Right in the middle of oppression. In 1933, I don't think you went on with medicine. A group of doctors visited him about a promotion of a campaign. They wanted to get together and do something. These are all our heart specialists. So he put it all together, and that's how you have American Heart Association. He did a lot of incredible things. I give him credit for being quite a guy.
It's nice that he's here.
Look, poor brothers.
Yes.
The death of my sister-in-law just devastated me. She was one of my favorite people, I must say that. It was quite a loss. And they had this incredibly beautiful house up on the Cape, and which he loved. With a lot of acreage and all that. It was a house built around 1780 and a stunning setup. And it's too big for him, all alone up there in this enormous thing. I actually convinced him he ought to sell the thing and just take life a little easier. He's never gotten over the Cape. He loved the wind, the wonderful air up there and all that. I don't blame him.
No.
The winter time just devastated him.
His son Richard.
I'm sorry?
His son Richard.
Yes, he's out in the West Coast.
And what does he do? Tell us about him.
Rick is a... He's the sort of man who runs conventions in a strange way. Right now, he represents the national building trades, the guys that build houses and, you know, this sort of thing. Not merely a house, but series of things. I can't tell you.
Developments
and all that. And my nephew lives out on a boat in Sausalito.
Oh, I know. Oh, lovely.
And he's that sort of a kid. He's not a kid anymore. He's past 50. I keep forgetting.
Married?
He was. No, it's not.
Children?
No. Which kills my brother.
You also talked about, and I did, we weren't able to...
End of side one, take two, continued on side two.
I was in charge.
No, okay. Okay, part of it.
Yeah.
When you were younger and
I
so
was
forth.
A kid then.
Yeah, when you were, yeah, okay, tell us about that. I know.